to the show. Today's guest is Matt Sonneson. He's a technology architect for the research and development team at Cedars-Sinai, a non-for-profit academic healthcare organization serving the diverse Los Angeles community and beyond. So, Matt, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Hell yeah. Well, dude, we've known each other for so long through punk and hardcore, you documenting it on video, through zines, and just like someone that I've known for a long time. So it's awesome to have you here. I also was like totally delighted to hear about this like totally wild career that I had. If someone had said to me like, hey, what does Matt do? I'd be like, I don't know. He's a very pleasant person who like documents hardcore.
Yeah, I'm pretty private about it. I kind of keep, you know, sometimes it's separate where you may not see me talk too much about it because it's kind of a weird specialized thing that I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't translate very easily into what most people think happens there.
Totally. Well, and I also know that there's a lot of, you can't disclose a lot of things, so we have to be cautious. So is there anything you want to say before we start up?
Sure. Yeah. So any of the opinions I have on here are strictly my own. I'm not representing anyone, you know, professionally or anything like that. So if you were to ask me about my favorite 7 inches, they are mine and not, you know, anything else.
Okay, cool. And then also like we'll play with the things if you're like, hey, actually, I can't talk about because of non-disclosure. It's no problem.
We can move with it.
All right, dude. I can barely work my iPhone and we were laughing about this earlier. So I can't even imagine what a technology architect is. So what is it?
Sure. So pretty much what I do on the R&D team is it's a somewhat small team and we are the strike team for the hospital. We find new technologies that, you know, may not be fully fledged, you know, and production ready. We try and see if they are production ready. We take our own in-house accelerator where we kind of incubate our own companies through a process and go through and kind of facilitate having them be successful, and not just in our hospital, but in other hospitals as well as part of their business plans. Mm-hmm. Pretty much you name it, we have to program it. If it's not something that we personally do program ourselves or code ourselves, we'll find the applicable team to do it. In the hospital, it requires anything that touches any type of patient data or, you know, is patient facing or anything like that. Requires so many checks and, you know, contingencies to make sure that there's no adverse, you know, events or, you know, anything like that of that nature. So it requires tons and tons and tons of hands to get things from, you know, a concept to a production stage where a patient can actually use it and we can glean, you know, actually good data from it. Mm-hmm. So we do it all. We make everything happen. So if you have an idea and you think it's a good idea, we facilitate seeing that thing to fruition.
Hell yeah. I want to get into how you got into this.
Sure.
There's like a funny sidebar story I want to take in that. But before we get into that, so just like anyone who's, most people in North America have heard of Cedars-Sinai, but like most people, I don't know a ton about hospitals.
Sure. Yeah. And neither did I when I started.
Right. So like when you're talking about like a strike team, first of all, is it actually called a strike team?
I guess in the sense of like we facetiously call ourselves that because we are responsible for just about every part of what we would call an electronic medical record. You may hear me say it's called an EMR. So essentially what it is your patient data record.
Right.
So for me, Matt Sonneson has all my medications I've ever taken, any problems I've had, if I had a chronic illness, injuries, all of those things are what make up an EMR record.
Right.
And we do things like process these records to do, you know, clinical research and all kinds of things like under that whole umbrella of the medical world. And so there's so much stuff that's all out there. And my team is all of it. Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's organ transplants or you sprained your knee.
Yeah.
My team does it. And we have to be responsible for a huge, you know, birth of all of these potential things that can be out there.
All right. So what need is this serving? Like,
yeah.
What was it like? Oh, we need this. So we have to get assemble this group of people to do it.
Yeah. So what had happened was, coincidentally, myself and the handful of other people, it's a very small team. It's like five people. We were all the respective leaders and managers of those teams that we, you know, had our specialties in. Mm-hmm. So for myself, I came from managing the data warehousing and business intelligence team. For people who may not know, data warehousing is actually like the structure of data, relational databases, things of that nature, and disseminating that data out. I worked a ton with the lead of the DBA team, the lead of the systems integration team, the lead of the systems architecture team. And then we all worked together just so much on all these very, very high profile, very specific projects eventually, my boss was a doctor there, and he decided, hey, you know, these guys have all known each other a real long time. They work very well together. I would jokingly say I'm the person with the least amount of experience. I've been at the hospital for almost 16 years, and I'm the youngest person. Right. You know what I mean? And so all of us kind of just came together. And I was like, we need to just have these people be on this team full time to facilitate these projects that we don't necessarily have the operational bandwidth for. Right. And so that's kind of how we came to be the strike team, of just saying like, well, you know, this team can't really support that. This team doesn't exactly have, you know, the bandwidth or the understanding of kind of these nuanced things or special skills. So we're going to give it to these guys, the R&D team, and they're going to figure out whether it's a viable product or not. And if it's not viable for us, is it something that's viable for other hospitals that may do things differently than the way we do it? Yeah. And so it's really kind of pushing the technology forward and making these huge leaps in advancement that, you know, nowadays it's going way faster than when I started in 2006 at the hospital.
So almost, and totally correct me if I've got this wrong, the hospital has all of these like technology hubs, essentially.
Correct. Yeah.
And these technology hubs are about like working with the existing things, making sure they're up to date, they're moving fast, they're doing the intended thing.
Right.
And this team that you're a part of is almost like an advanced scouting party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So you're figuring out the lay of the land of the things that could be, should be, might be.
Yeah.
You're investigating that and then seeing its application for the, within the existing existing
teams. And if it's a viable product, we implement it and we get it to the stage of maturity where we can transition it off to the support teams to handle it.
So do people come to you with emerging technology and be like, hey, we've got this thing, or are you out in the field?
It's all everything. I mean, we have an accelerator. And
so what does that mean, an accelerator?
An accelerator, we were probably one of the, I could be wrong, maybe I'm wrong. But we were one of the probably the first hospitals to do this in 2015. And so essentially what you can think of it as is almost like a Shark Tank, where we would interview companies, maybe say like 50 to 100 companies, and they would come and they would pitch their ideas. They may have a technology. They may have thought of one and don't exactly know how to understand it. And there was a couple companies that had actually had a pretty flushed out idea. They had the software, but they just hadn't gotten into the hospital world. And so we invest in their companies, and it goes to the board, and people pick, and we choose, and we interview them. And it's a pretty very rigorous process of, you know, interviews and all these things. And then if they're chosen, they spend 90 days on site here in Beverly Hills, and we work with them to facilitate anything they need. So literally we sit in there and say, hey, you know, I noticed that you need to do this with your code. Patient data can only reside in this type of encrypted server within these constraints. You know, we'll penetration test to make sure that, you know, we've covered all these holes. You know, we don't think this is a viable way of transferring data. Maybe you should do it like this. And so a lot of people don't know that because it's not something that they've ever done before. And so it allows them to kind of work with us and have us facilitate a lot of things that they would never in a million years have access to.
Can I give you like a punk example?
Sure.
It's like, you and your friends are writing songs in your basement and you got your band and you're like, this is we just wrote an awesome record,
yeah.
But then you take it to a producer.
Right.
And the producer's like, that song is too long. You should do a key switch here. Like, you got to get rid of that song.
Yeah, entirely. Yeah, yeah.
Save that chorus, move this over here.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. And be it people we find, you know, say, you know, VP or the board says, hey, I saw this interesting, you know, commercial, or I read a paper. What is this? How do we do this? You know, and they kick it over to us and we go, okay, cool. Well, we'll research it and we'll figure it out. And we'll, if it's a viable technology, we'll run with it. You know, so it comes from all sides and all places. We say no to very little things. I mean, because everything out there we want to do to make sure that, you know, one, that, you know, Cedars is kind of at the forefront of all of these burgeoning technologies. And two, I mean, it really is really beneficial, the things that we can do with all of this data that we have. And we've had our current setup for about 2009 is when we started our first major implementation into it. And so we've got a little more than 10 years worth of data now. So we are really cranking out the research and stuff like that.
Yeah. And certainly not that you have to give us a super in-depth explanation, mm-hmm. but it sounds like what's happening at Cedars-Sinai is actually like pretty unique.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. So I can share some funny stories. When we got the software that we use, it's one of the big main EMRs in the world. There's not a whole lot of them. Mm-hmm. And their headquarters is in Madison, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so this is the only hospital I've ever worked at. I came from the world of banking and finance and other things. data warehousing and that. And so when I went out there, you know, I met a lot of people who did at the time similar things that I did as a systems developer for data warehousing. And they were nurses and they were clinicians and they were administrators. And they were like, oh man, I don't know how to do this. How do I write this code? Why am I doing this? And, you know, and we were fortunate enough to come from a company that invests, you know, very much in technology. And they hired people like me who've been coding for, you know, 25 years and things like that. And I met all these other people and I was like, oh, wow. I mean, people who wasn't their job. I mean, they were doing it to facilitate, you know, learning and helping the organization, but that wasn't their full-time job. They're like, oh, you know, I can code an hour a night and things like that. And it really kind of hit me like, wow, I mean, that's really cool that we are in the position to be fortunate enough to value that type of development in that case where, you know, a lot of people that are very, very, very smart that I've worked with, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have on my team or teams in the, you know, in our structure that I can learn from and we can really push the envelope on. I mean, pretty consistently, Cedars is one of the top hospitals in the United States.
Right.
We're number one in, you know, in a lot of specialties and things of that nature. And it's really cool to reap the reward of that, you know, being a part of that family.
Yeah. And what stands out to me here is like, it's a very forward thinking to like have like an in-house R&D arm at all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think that's that common for hospitals.
No, most definitely not. No.
And so like a lot of hospitals would be like outsourcing for all technology. Correct. And like going with like the big med technology.
Yes.
Companies.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is done by consultants and things of that nature, you know, people that are not on site.
Right. So Cedars-Sinai actually set up their own in-house arm for R&D. And within that, your team is nestled.
Yeah. 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 So, yeah. So, we're really, really, really fortunate and we get to work on some, you know, insanely cool projects, like just things that, you know, you would never think would be possible. And it's our job to make that possible. I really enjoy it.
So tell us about where you grew up.
Sure.
And your initial path into coding.
Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly what you'd expect. I'm from South Sacramento, which is probably not exactly one of the, you know, the greatest suburbs of Sacramento. Uh-huh. My dad, when I was a kid, I have an older brother. He moved the two of us into, you know, we lived in a very small house. We put us in the same room together and he said, hey, you know what? I'm going to start a server room and I'm going to create a bulletin board system. And this is 1982, 1983, right? Uh-huh. Bulletin board system, you know, like most people had no idea. And so my dad bought like 10 phone lines to go to my old bedroom, set up a bunch of computers, ran one of the first bulletin boards, you know, in the world, pretty much, called the City of Gray. And it facilitated like chat rooms and file sharing and things that were all, you know, hey, this line doesn't work. You know, I'm going to use my, you know, 1600 baud modem and try and, you know, get on there and I'm going to transfer files. And he set up all this stuff. And so we grew up, my brother and I, kind of with this like wonderment of like, wow, I mean, computer, like that's crazy. I mean, could you imagine telling someone in the early 80s, yeah, I got kicked out of my room because my dad set up a server room in there. Right. You know what I mean? Like I'd be a kid and, you know, they'd be like, hey, what do you want to do when you grow up? I'm like, oh, I want to program computers. I want to do this. I want to do that. And people would just be like, yeah, okay, sure, kid. Like, whatever you say. Like, yeah, computers. Well, we'll see where those go.
Right.
And so, I mean, I grew up just really, really, really cutting my teeth on like my dad saying, hey, I don't care what you do. You can play games if you want. If you can figure out how to run it, you can play it. And so, you know, just very simple commands in DOS and being like, okay, well, how do I run a game? And then, you know, writing it down and figuring it out. And you'd be like 5 or 6 or something like that. And so really just kind of getting that, you know, coding and coding and coding and being like, okay, yeah, I can run this game. And, you know, I can play these super hard adult complex games and things like that of that nature. And it really just stuck with me like, man, like, this is what I want to do. This is what I enjoy. And it's something I enjoy and, you know, something that I really practice being good at. And so, you know, I got into high school and in the early 90s, still kind of the same thing, like AOL, kind of some net stuff, not a whole lot. You know, I taught myself to code. I was actually thankful enough to get my programming class then. And I learned C and we programmed BASIC and a lot of stuff like that in like 1993. Mm-hmm. So it was lucky in that regard that my school even taught those things. Mm-hmm. I took a digital art class. I learned how to use Photoshop in like 1995, you know, in the school and education. And it was really cool. We had a lot of donations being in California from places like Apple and things like of that nature. So we were lucky enough to have things that, and I just really, really, really got into it. And then eventually, you know, I found a job at Allstate, and they probably made a killing off me. I was in high school, and I was working in their data warehouse developing databases.
Well, first of all, how did you find that job in high school? So like, yeah. In high school, I washed dishes at Boston Pizza.
Yeah,
like,
so you're going to laugh. I joined the Business Education Technology. So you can only imagine
in high school.
Yes, in high school.
I'm not laughing.
Only imagine, you know, that what most people would think of would be, you know, like preppy kids, you know, kids that were very studious, you know, people that kind of, you know, meet that stereotype. Right. And here's me, you know, probably with some tattered hardcore shirt and a skateboard. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm gonna figure this out, and I'm gonna do, you know, I'm gonna code, and I'm gonna be fancy, you know, technology.
Is that your youth voice? Is that how you
talk?
Yeah,
exactly. Today? Right. Like, yeah, yeah.
This is what I
too cool for school.
When did your voice change?
Yeah, I know. Probably like, I don't know, when I was like in my 20s. Right. Okay. So I very much did not look the way I did now. I was a, you know, 6'3", 100-pound dorky kid, yeah. You know, with a skateboard. And I had thought like, hey, this is cool. Like, you know, lots of my friends were not into anything like that. Most of my friends weren't even into showing up to school.
Yeah.
You know? And so for me, I was like, this is cool. Like, this is something that I think I'm good at and I can really facilitate it. And then I would jokingly say I didn't want to do hard labor or things like that.
Right.
And so I got a job there, and they got me an internship at Allstate. And I just really hit it off doing things that, you know, I kind of thought I was decent at, and it was things that not a whole lot of people did. So they probably, you know, really lucked out that it was something I liked doing and they had a spot for me. And so I started developing like databases and inputting the data myself. And it was kind of cool to learn like, oh, hey, you know, if I'm going to be the person that simultaneously inputs this and builds it, I should probably do it this way. What would be things that would make my job easier? How can I report on this better? How can I flow this data into their overall picture? You know, and so it was kind of like doing both ends of the work, like inputting it, because I'm a summer student, you know, I was inputting like surveys about insurance and things like that. Mm. And then getting that data to flow into their organizational structure so people could actually use it. Yeah. You know, it was pretty fun.
So it started with an internship. Did it turn into a job though?
No. So after that, I worked there for a while. And then I think they had like lost their funding or something of that nature. And then I worked at the Department of Health and Human Services in Sacramento.
Still in high school or?
Yeah, I just graduated. And so I worked there for a bit, and it was kind of cool because.
And this was an actual job.
Yeah, yeah, it was a real job. Yeah, because
the other one, the internship never turned into an actual job.
No, surprisingly, it did not.
So that wrapped up. Then you start your first like.
My first
job out of high school.
Yeah.
Again, I was packing groceries out of high school. I like, not that that's a bad job, but it's a unique story.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I did work at a record store. I worked at like Tower Records for like a day. I don't think they liked my personality. I worked at, you know, some other odds and ends, but I went pretty much straight like to doing these kind of office jobs. I'm like, hey, you know, I get paid a little bit more. I get to work in air conditioning, you know, I don't have to, it's not really strenuous work, you know, and it's stuff that really, you know, I can think about and ruminate on it and really kind of hone these skills. And it was really cool. Like that really interested me. And so when I got a job at the department for the state or the county rather, it was in a terrible spot of Sacramento. It was under an overpass. Nobody wanted to work there. It wasn't exactly in the safest part of the city. And I remember interviewing there and them saying like, you know, are you sure you want to work here? And I was, you know, a wide-eyed kid. I was like, yeah, sure. Why wouldn't I? Like, you guys are paying me, you know, $10 when the minimum wage is $5 or $4, you know, like, heck yeah, I want to work here. Yeah. And so I got in there and I started working on their financial databases and things of that nature. And then I started learning about how like check, you know, processing works. And I could do reports and say, you know, EBTs go here and, you know, check processing goes there, and the stats and the charts and the graphs and all these things behind that. And so it's really cool. I learned a lot doing that.
Well, what's fascinating for me is like you were you're a legit kid.
Yeah.
And this was kind of at the emergence of the internet.
Correct.
So,
yeah.
So there was not like a generation who had gone before you who could be like, oh, hey, young person coming into the business.
Yeah, by and large, I have always been until, you know, recently the youngest person on every team I've ever worked on.
Yeah. Well, but like very specifically though, going back to that time, like when you joined this first job, like, was there actually even like any kind of like proper thing set up, or were you still kind of basically building it all?
Yeah, no. I mean, they had some stuff. It was mostly like mainframe servers and things of that nature. And so what essentially they had done was just been like, hey, I don't know. They didn't know either. They were like, we're not tech people. Mm-hmm. We're like, the tech department's over in, you know, like Paramus, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. We need somebody on site that can figure out how to store all the stuff with us, and by the same token, figure out how to get that data to those guys.
But that's by today's standards, and I might be wrong.
Oh, no, you're quite right. It was barbaric.
Well, but also just like the idea, like, hey, like, were you still a teenager at this point? Hey, teenager.
Yeah, I know, right? Come, 17-year-old.
Hey, teenager, come in here and take all this ultra-sensitive data and figure something out that we as adults have no idea about.
Exactly. I mean, and that's exactly like what it was.
That sounds like madness to me.
Could you imagine doing that now? Just being like, yeah, we got some kid from this high school program. I mean, he seems all right. I don't know. He smells fine. You know, like, you can go sit in a cube and listen to records and do whatever, you know? And literally, that is what they did. So it was a bunch of adults that, you know, for whatever reason, didn't understand it. You know, they didn't know how to do it.
Well, they didn't understand it because it was a new thing. It wasn't a thing.
Right.
Like, dude, I didn't get my first email address until 95 or 96. I didn't even have
First. Yeah. Oh, like, yeah, dude, we were my brother and I were on the net in the 80s and stuff like that. Like, it was crazy. And we were kids. Like, crazy people.
You were like very early on at a very young age, super involved in what would be like kind of emerging technology.
Oh yeah, most definitely. My dad, he sold a bunch of code, like, you know, to the state and all these other companies and stuff like that. You know, he met all these people from Microsoft and, you know, did all these things back then, you know, in the 80s when like that stuff was really, you know, not what we think of now today. Like everybody knows Microsoft, everybody knows Windows. It's a multi-billion dollar national company. Yeah. My dad held the door open for, you know, Bill Gates at a meeting in Sacramento in 1983. So like, you know, dragging us along, you know, as a snot-nosed kids going like, oh, why do I have to go to these boring meetings? You know, and we sit there and it kind of just filters in. You know, learn about it whether you chose to or not.
Yeah. So you were into all of this very young.
Oh,
yeah. You get this job where basically like there's no adults in the room.
No.
Like they're just like, you do whatever you want.
Oh,
do. Just do this job and you figure out how to
do it. They did not care how it got done as long as it made, you know, life easier for them.
All right. So how long were you in that role?
Probably for most of my senior year. You know what I mean?
So you were in college at this point?
No, I was in high school.
Okay.
Wait,
so this is the job that you were getting paid for?
Oh, yeah. I got paid for it still as an internship. Okay. Oh, but when I went to the state, the county, I worked there for a couple of years.
And
I was like 18, 19 or something like that.
18, 19.
Yeah.
And were you in college at that time or just working?
Yeah. I was in college. I worked kind of just and went to school and did my homework, you know, at work sometimes when I had the opportunity. And if not, then I just did school when I could do it, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah, I must have been at the stage for a bit. And it was right leading up to the, it sounds silly to talk about now, but the 2000 change when, you know, things were rolling from 1999 to 2000. You know, everyone was worried and, you know, oh, the database is going to crash. Will people get their checks? Will we still be able to report? And it was fine. But, you know, I mean, just remember like that whole big lead up to, you know, people thinking that it was going to be like the end of the world, you know? Yeah. And so I got to be there for that, which was kind of silly.
You're working like deep in the forefront of technology. When that was happening, I was rappelling down buildings and cleaning the windows and like going to college, like I was going to university. But again, I was like, you know, like ham fisting it through, like, you know, cleaning windows and everything. So it's, I love this. Then what happened next? So
yeah.
You did that.
So I worked on a couple of new technologies. Maybe you might've heard of this one. I worked on Makeout Club.
I was going to ask
you about it. Yeah. You know, Gibby, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hold on. We're going to talk about Makeout Club in a second, but that was just like, you didn't quote unquote work for them. Did you? Did you get a paycheck?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you were working for the state.
Yeah.
Was that? And then what next? You worked at Makeout Club.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I kind of thought that I was going to be Mr. Cool and, you know, do all these things. And so,
Mr. Cool.
Yeah. Like, you know, I was in kind of some hardcore bands and nothing, you know, really huge and of note. But I, you know, I was trying to be Mr. Scene and doing this stuff. And so, I stopped working for the state and tried freelance for a couple of years. And
so you're doing like, you had a stable gig, but at a point you're like, hey, I just want to work for myself or do
pretty much make my own hours
or do something with kind of like people that I see eye to eye.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really thought that like, you know, working like with people I was friendly with or, you know, in the same subculture and those things, like we could, you know, boost stuff much further than you get if, you know, people that weren't in that subculture were doing it.
Right.
It was kind of still a specialized task in 2000, you know, not very many people were, you know, DBAs, which what I ended up doing for them or things of that nature. Like it was really uncommon. And so for me to kind of have that skill set from, you know, what you think of as the traditional corporate world and apply it to a subculture, I thought was actually really cool.
How did you find Makeout Club or how did they find you?
So the trouble, Blood for Blood, did a split on Victory with my friends in Powerhouse and Pressure Point.
Yeah.
And so I remember when that came out and I didn't know, you know, the guys from The Trouble or Blood for Blood or any of that. And so, but I did know my friends from the West Coast side of the split. And I listened to that 7-inch bunch. And so just coincidentally, when Gibby had started and he had all those ideas for the site, literally, like I must have been in the very beginning before it even, you know, started being what it was. And I hit him up and I was like, hey, dude, like, you know, we have all these mutual friends. You know, I know your band. I'm familiar with all this stuff. Like I have this set of skills, like let me help you out. You know, maybe we can do something cool. And he was just kind of like, rad. Well, awesome. You know, like I'm all about it. And so there wasn't a whole lot of other people that were helping out with him at the time. And so I did a bunch of like DBA stuff for them.
What's DBA?
Database management, like making user profiles. I mean, for people who may not know, Makeout Club was probably one of the first big social networks for a subculture, way before Friendster and anything else of that sort.
We were just talking about this yesterday. I was with friends of the show, John, and I was with John Jenkins, and then also Andrew Klein, who's a great friend of the show, and then also my girlfriend, Monica.
Yeah.
And we were trying to explain to Monica what Makeout Club was.
Oh, really?
And her jaw, she was like, what?
Yeah.
This existed?
Yeah.
So explain to everyone what Makeout Club was and when it was, because it's a crazy story.
Right. So probably on the latter end, the tail end of 1999, Gibby Miller from, you may know from Panic or The Trouble and those bands, Deus Records is like a huge label now. Mm-hmm. He had the idea to create a site where it was much more than, you know, just like a message board or, you know, kind of just like a hit and run place. You know, it had like profiles and people will talk about bands and people will talk about music and you could post, you know, all these things and interact with all these people. And so if you think about it, I think Friendster must have been like, what, 2003 or 2004, maybe?
Yeah.
This was light years before that. I mean, so much earlier than that. And so it was this huge hub of, you know, this chunk of the internet where all these people were, you know, if you were into hardcore or emo or indie or, you know, new wave or whatever, you could go and you can find like-minded people and you can meet people with the same interests as you and interact and do and just kind of hang out like a spot online where you could do that. It wasn't really anywhere like that. You could do things of that caliber that were done so well on the internet in 2000. You know?
Yeah. Like this might sound so odd to people. It was like Facebook before Facebook.
Literally. Yeah.
And it was in a very basic format. So it didn't have a format, anything like that. But I have friends today that I met through Makeout Club. And I know the name. It's like, here I am. I'm a grown man.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Makeout Club and this important role that it played. But also the fact that it was called Makeout Club was actually like really like kind of like outsider thinking.
Yeah.
It was super.
The unrest song. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was super like attractive to youth.
Yeah.
You know, and like there are couples that exist today because of that. There are babies that were born because of Makeout Club.
Yeah.
There's bands that were formed. So there are friends that were had.
Anyone out there that I'm friends with that I put on page one, you probably owe me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because also you had to go from page to page.
Yeah, I mean, back then, it didn't really. I mean, you could search profiles and you could find like people. But by the same token, you know, there was just you just browse through stuff and be like, oh, hey, this person looks cool. Or like, oh, I know this guy or I know this girl or whatever. And so essentially like the first, probably like the first five pages of guys that were on there were all people that, you know, I knew or people that Gibby was friends with or, you know what I mean? And people would, you know, hit me up and be like, hey man, can you move me up on the list? You know, I'm trying to find
strong,
you know,
networking.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, or you know, I think otherwise, you know, people will be like, hey, I'm calling in a favor. I'm going to need you to move me off page, you know, 10,011 up to page 2. I know it's a tall order, but I think you can do it for me. You know,
dude, it's so hilarious talking about it now. Cause like, again, we get people from all walks of life that listen to the show. Some people here are going to be like, oh, I've heard of that. Some people are like, oh, I was on that.
Totally.
And some people are like, God, like, does Aram only interview weirdos? like we're like,
yeah, right.
Makeout
Club. Technology dinosaurs here. We're really aging ourselves.
Well, but it's an interesting thing. Cause like Makeout Club, I hope I'm not overstating this. It was like a significant moment
of
culture, at least within our subculture.
Definitely. 1,000%.
But I actually say it was a significant moment in what could be from a technology standpoint, how mm-hmm. we're socially connected with each other.
Yeah. People could use it to book tours. You could find people in cities, mm-hmm. you know, find people for shows, be like, hey, I know this guy is in this band, but I don't know him. How can I find him? I'm going to go look.
Yeah.
You know?
So you leave your job, you start working with Gibby on that, and that mm-hmm. becomes how you make your living.
Pretty much, yeah, freelancing. I did that. I did odds and ends. I was doing art for labels and stuff like that. I did art for like Victory Records. Shout out to my friend Steve at Martyr Records. I did a bunch of art for him, Livewire Records, Radical Records. I did any type of art, you know what I mean? If you were like a hardcore label and, you know, hey, you know, we need this, or we need a press kit made, or we need posters, or we need a layout, did that too, you know?
Yeah, definitely shout out to Steve, Martyr Records, and then Heroes and Martyrs.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
Great to have you back, man. That's cool. So just to stick out with Makeout Club, and I might hit up Gibby one time, just do an episode.
Oh,
on
you
that.
Should. He's great. He's got fantastic stories. Well, I'll leave to him.
It's such an interesting thing. It ended suddenly.
Yeah, kind of.
What happened?
So you may want to save that one for him to tell the exact details, because he'll have some great stories about it. But for a while, server bills were astronomical. I mean, you know, $10,000 to $20,000, you know, per month for a bunch of hardcore kids. Like, I don't have 20 grand sitting around to pay for, you know, bills and things like that. I don't think anyone did.
Yeah.
And so the cost just kept skyrocketing and skyrocketing and skyrocketing. And so eventually, I think, you know, some people invested in it, and it kind of did that. And I think Gibby also kind of, I don't want to speak for him, but I know he got his hands into all kinds of other stuff. And so, I mean, honestly, you should bring him on. There are so many great, wild stories from that.
I want you to imagine grown adults in a parking lot eating vegan tacos.
Yeah.
This is what we were doing yesterday. We're sitting around like a bunch of young hardcore kids after our show. We're not in chairs. We're like sitting on the ground.
Right, right.
And it's all like older people talking about Makeout Club.
Oh, yeah.
In 2022. And been like, damn, like that was so ahead of the curve. Like that could have been turned into a multi. He could be Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. He could be.
And wasn't. It's a great story. I'm going to hit up Gibby. I think that would be really
cool. He's got all kinds of wild stuff about that. I mean, those were literally like the Wild West days of, you know, him hitting me up and being like, dude, can, you know, we get some pictures. We're going to be in like Rolling Stone. Or we're going to be in Spin, you know, talking about this. Or at one point it was in Time Magazine. Time Magazine did a feature on it.
Which is crazy because it's just a bunch of hardcore kids.
Literally.
Something.
Yeah.
All right. So you do the freelance thing for a while, and then what?
I got a job. I decided at some point I should probably go back to getting a more stable job, stable income. And I got a job with AT&T. I worked on a project called SLIM, the Strategic Lease Information Management.
That sounds ultra interesting.
Wow. I loved it. It was great. So what it was their data warehouse. And it was about cell phone. This is about the time when cell phones started happening.
Right.
I mean, in 2002 and 2003, we really started seeing, you know, a cell phone. Like, obviously, I had a cell phone in the 90s, but it was pretty archaic. And the ones in 2000 were not much better. Yeah. But I worked in AT&T, and it was the database for tracking, you know, the megahertz of whatever towers were in this area and the radius and how far, you know, the bandwidth could go across. You know, I mean, really very interesting stuff. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, cutting edge. And so I worked there for about 4 years or so.
And this is on the Slim project?
Yeah.
Was there anyone named Jim that worked
there? Yeah, I know, right?
Was there?
No, that would have been great, though. I will tell you a good story, though, that I remember at one point, it was such kind of a slapdash thing. Somebody had plugged a space heater into a circuit. And for the record, no one should ever put a server on a shared circuit like that. And they plugged a space heater in and it blew out one of the servers while I was there. And so, I mean, just like... head and hand style stuff, you know what I mean? Like someone plugged a space heater in on the other side of the wall and the circuit was shared with the inside of the server room and it blew it out. And so, I mean, like I just have so many groan worthy stories about my time there.
And also this is still relatively new technology. So people wouldn't necessarily,
I mean, to be fair to the person who did it, you wouldn't think if you're plugging your space heater in, you know, to the wall, it's going to have, you know, a giant rack on the other side.
Mistakes were made, lessons were learned.
Yeah, right? I know, right?
So you worked there and then, and then what happened?
And so around that time in 2006, AT&T was originally split from, you know, Ma Bell or whatever. And then Singular bought AT&T again or however that works. And I got stuck on the transition from ETL. And when I say ETL, extract, transform, and load, loading the data from Slim over to Singulink, which was the Singular database. And so that was even less interesting to me than working on Slim.
Right.
And essentially they gave me the option of saying, hey, you know, you seem like a clever guy. You've done, you know, some really cool stuff here. Would you like to move to Atlanta and work at Singular's headquarters? And I said, absolutely not. No, I'm born and bred in California. It didn't really interest me. I didn't like working for the phone company. That was just not things that, you know, I really had an interest in pursuing in that environment. And so I said, all right, well, great. Essentially you're laid off then. You know, you can fill out your time here and we're going to have you do this stuff. The longer you stay here, the more work you do, the more severance pay you get. And that's that. And so great. Thanks to see you. Bye. And so I was kind of in this weird lurch of being like, well, I mean, I don't know what else I'm going to do. I'd still like to continue doing these things, but I don't know if I want to do it here in Sacramento, still where I was. Do I want to do it in San Francisco? You know, I spent a lot of time in the Bay Area. And then shortly after that happened, I happened to get a call from a recruiter in Beverly Hills, California. You know, and I was like, wow, stars in my eyes. And they're like, hey, you know, we noticed that, you know, you have a real extensive experience in data warehousing and writing SQL and databases and, you know, reporting engines and all these kind of things. And, you know, we think you might be a good fit for some new technology we have here. And I thought, well, great. I mean, I can report on anything. Database is a database is a database. I can figure it out. You know, I'm a clever guy. And so I came down to Beverly Hills and did some interviews and kind of learned what they were doing. And then the rest, we just really hit it off. I mean, it was crazy. It was cool because when I started in the hospital in 2006, essentially there were not things like medical records. I mean, all of these things that, you know, you can have a diabetes monitor and connect it to your phone now, and you can send those results to your doctor. None of that was just figment in someone's imagination back then. There were mainframes handling billing, you know, claims data, things of that nature. But in an electronic medical record, as we know, it really, really, really didn't exist much more than just some text files that were scanned in from a PDF from a lab or, you know, some repositories and things like that.
Yeah. So let's draw it back many years.
Yeah.
Because on the flip side, you got this professional career that's growing. And on the other side, you're this young kid involved in punk and hardcore.
Yeah.
So how did you find punk?
Essentially, you know, I got into like metal and so all that kind of stuff in the, you know, the early 90s. I have an older brother. I think he's a little older than you. We're very similar.
The way you just said that is if there's like inconceivable, like
right,
inconceivable,
I know,
someone
right?
older than
yeah.
you.
Yeah, we're close age. I know, right? I think he's a little older than you. And so he was into like hardcore and punk and Repo Man, Beastie Boys, and, you know, Agnostic Front, kind of all these things. And so me, you know, kind of tagging along, I got to, you know, to experience Black Flag in the 80s as, you know, like an 8-year-old or something like that.
You went to these
shows. No, but he would go.
Oh, he would
go. And my dad would, you know, moan incessantly, like, why are you going to these shows? And that's a waste of time and blah, 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 blah. You know, kind of all these things. And to me as a kid, I thought that was just like the coolest thing in the world. You know what I mean? Like, wow, that's so rad. And so when I got into high school, I think I started high school in like 1993 or something like that. Some of the kids from my neighborhood would go on to be in the Hoods. And so, you know,
for the uninitiated, the Hoods are kind of a legendary West Coast band focused in Sacramento.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A big, big, big band from, you know, Sacramento at the time and hardcore and stuff like that. And so I went to school with Mario and Mike, and they were my neighbors. And they would join Mikey Hood in the Hoods, you know, in the mid 90s. And to me, I was like, whoa, that's cool. Like, these guys I know, you know, just like me, I have class at PE classes, we hang out, we skateboard, are in a band. Like, wow, I could really relate to that. I mean, I couldn't play an instrument or anything like that to save my life, but it was something that I was super, super interested in. And so, you know, they started going on tour and, you know, getting really good and doing all these things and, like, you know, really becoming musicians. And I kind of just tagged along for the ride to just go to shows. And as I went to shows, I learned that like the dudes from the band Focal Point were at the next high school over, pretty close to my age. I worked at a record store for a second when I was in high school with Don Clark. And I just remember bugging him incessantly about like every question about every record or whatever known to man. And so the more and more I just started going to shows and meeting more people, it was really cool kind of getting that exposure and seeing all these people that were like me, you know what I mean? Like, prior to that, I thought like, oh, well, if you want to play music or be involved in music, it's some big arena, you know, kind of thing, like seeing Slayer at Arco Arena or something like that.
Right.
Not like going to a show and seeing people from that I went to school with, you know, playing music and playing music well and everyone, you know, stage diving and, you know, moshing and hanging from the rafters and doing all this crazy stuff, which I just was all about, you know?
Right. At what point did you start like documenting things in the scene?
Yeah. So, I could not play an instrument very well. I can't draw, my handwriting is terrible. A lot of things of that nature, but what I could do was I had a computer and my parents bought me a video camera. I got a digital video camera in the 90s, which was crazy, right? Yeah. And so Mikey Hood created West Coast Worldwide in the summer of 1999. Myself, a couple other guys, we painted it and kind of tended it, and it was our garden, and it was a place for everyone to hang out in Sacramento because it didn't really have anything like that. And so just by going to all these shows that were happening, and, you know, literally there were like shows every night, be it, you know, a couple hundred people, and some shows were like 10 people, but it was always the same group of people putting it on and, you know, seeing the shows. And I just happened to be there with a camera and videotaped a ton of stuff. I mean, just so much stuff. And I got to meet tons of people and, you know, do all these things that I wouldn't have been able to do if it wasn't for that building being there, because shows were not easily accessible. And especially because, you know, my age, I wasn't, you know, 21 in the 90s. So I couldn't go to bar shows. I remember having to sneak into shows or have people, you know, get their markers and rub them off on me so I could go in and things like that in my hand. And so it was really cool. And it allowed, you know, all these things to happen, you know, that I would just forever, you know, stay with me and be like, man, I just love all of this so much. The excitement, the energy, you know, meeting people, doing things, you know, experiencing the music this way in such kind of a personal way. It was really, really, really cool. I mean, guys, we saw so many good shows there.
Yeah. You love these kind of like dual lives, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You're working like cutting edge technology, like really like doing stuff that essentially you're building what's to be.
Oh, yeah.
And you're also like watching meatheads like punish each other in the pit.
Yes. So me sitting in a cube with like a black eye or something like that, you know what I mean? Just typing away, you know, fervently or what have you on some weird stuff.
But you kept these worlds pretty separated.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. How come? I don't know. Like, I kind of felt that, I mean, in a way, now I think it's very different, but I don't feel like, you know, being an egghead or sometimes maybe being of like that nature, people might perceive me differently, you know, back then.
Right.
Or people think like, oh, you know, he can, you know, type his name. He might think he's smarter than everyone. Right. Or he might think this or that or whatever.
So you were worried. You were worried how people would perceive. But what about in the corporate world? Did you
in the corporate world? Yeah, I got that too. So it was kind of like in that world of people being like, what the heck is that weird kid up to all the time? Like,
well, did you have like tattoos back then?
Everything? Yeah, kind of. Like, kind of more sporadically. You know, I was kind of a big gangly kid, and probably, you know, I didn't have as much life experience or interpersonal skills the way I might now, if you assume that I can, you know, interact properly and not like a caveman. So yeah, it was kind of like being caught between both worlds of doing these things that I really like doing. And, you know, I feel very passionate about, and I also feel very passionate about a subculture and all the things of that nature. So kind of wafting in between and not really, you know, being 100% in either one.
Yeah, because you're like what I call, and I was talking to John about this, John Jenkins yesterday. It's like you're a true lifer for punk and hardcore.
Yeah, and there's no going back at this point.
No, but you also like, you actually like are a fan of the music. Like, yeah. You actually like a lot of different kinds of hardcore. You're not.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Because, you know, hardcore can kind of be, not kind of be, it can be very like.
Yeah, people are very specific and very rigid.
Pick a lane, stay in your lane, be a little judgmental. But like, you actually like a ton of different stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Most definitely.
And you've always supported bands like by picking their stuff up. You've
Oh, yeah, dude. Anything I can. The way I see it is like, I mean, I know in 2022, you can stream anyone's stuff. Yeah. You can go to YouTube and find some records. But I mean, if my friends or bands I like or things I think are cool are doing the footwork to actually make something, you know, like merchandise, like a shirt or a book or posters or records or anything like that, you know, I'll do everything I can to possibly support, you know, the things that I believe in and the things that I like.
Yeah. And it's an interesting thing. Cause like I said to you earlier, it's like, I had no idea about your professional life. Yeah. If someone said, what do you do? I'd be like, I don't know.
Yeah. He hangs out on the internet all day. Yeah.
Like post photos.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But like, here you are, you've got these lives. When did you start feeling comfortable about like kind of merging them a little bit more?
Gosh, I don't know. Never. I mean, I would jokingly say that in a weird way, in the world of academia, working at the medical center, I would jokingly say, I joke, I'm like, I'm normal to these people. You know what I mean? These people are like, oh, that guy, oh, he's normal. Yeah.
Because why? Because they're so smart.
Right. Because they are so, you know, in their own world of publishing papers and research and, you know, all this really kind of out there, very specific things to you know, I'm kind of a, you know, like just a regular guy for them, you know, like I don't probably look, I'm not wearing a lab coat. I don't like wearing a suit, which I have to do sometimes, things of that nature. And so, yeah, I mean, over the years, it's gotten kind of more and more and more. And so, I don't know, maybe there's one day where I'll be fully comfortable, but.
Well, it's an interesting thing. By the way, you should have shown up here in a suit and a lab coat. Oh, you should have worn both at the same time.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing about like, how can you bring who you really are into all areas of your life? And it sounds like something that you've had to maybe, I don't know if the word struggle with.
But yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, I mean, so the cool things are is like in a professional capacity, my work, I think, kind of speaks to that more so than perhaps my, you know, my interactions with people and things. But like making zines and doing art, you know, I did a bunch of classes in school for like how to lay out newspapers and things like that. And then I did zines and, you know, whatever else. And so now a lot of times visualization engines are a huge big thing, you know, and with data. And, you know, showing people, not telling people, making charts, interactive things, infographs, all these things. You know, I've read a ton of books from like Andy Cosgrove and Edward Tufte and Candlis and these people that are like, you know, very famous in what they do and how they present data and how you can digest it. And it's cool when I can do the things that I know how to do, like lay things out in a way where people can digest it. And then simultaneously, you know, all of these things I've learned, you know, showing people how to track like heart transplants and things like that and bringing them back into hardcore and being like, wow, I can really like lay this out really cool in this record, or I can put this article together for my friend and or some advertisements, you know, that really grab your eye and disseminate what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah. So I always reference this because it always stood out to me so much. Do you remember that band Half Off?
Oh, it sounds awfully familiar.
They were like a Southern California.
Yeah.
Like kind of, I'd say more of a punk band than a hardcore band, but like punk hardcore or whatever. Half Off were sick, totally sick. The singer is a guy named Billy Rubin, who's like one of those like too smart for your own good kind of guys, like real, real smart.
Yeah.
Really, and very like critical of the punk scene and like the conformity that comes in the punk scene, but like came up in the punk scene. And he was interviewed for Vice a few years ago, and he had this quote, and I'm going to totally massacre it, but basically it was like, hey, what's something from the punk scene that didn't serve you in your adult life?
Yeah.
And he said, the idea that everything that I think should be voiced, or that my opinion on everything matters.
Oh, I agree 1,000% on that.
Well, and let me play it out. Basically, it was like, you know, like I grew up in the punk, and especially in the straight edge scene where people are like,
right,
like use your voice, like, you know, speak your mind, like all this stuff. And it was like, as if my opinions were more important than anyone else's opinion. And I felt like I was supposed to shout out every single thing. And you just get to a point where like, nobody wants to be around that person.
Yeah.
And I had to learn how to pick my spots and share when I had something of value to say rather than opinion. So with that in mind, is there anything from coming up in punk and hardcore that has been caused a barrier for you in your professional life?
Yeah. I mean, very much so. I wholeheartedly agree with that, where, you know, where it's like, I have this opinion and I think I'm right. I don't maybe have any evidence to say that I'm right, but I feel that I'm right. And I feel that I know better than the people who may think that I'm wrong.
Right.
So I'm going to dig in, and I'm going to be rigid, and I'm going to be inflexible, and I'm going to be stone-minded, and I'm going to pound this idea into the ground so everyone sees it, you know? And in my youth, I had a lot of that, where I thought, you know, maybe I had the best way to do it. And my way is definitely the best way, or this is the only way to do things. And the more I kind of experienced just life in general, and working with other people and working in this environment, you know, I got a lot more flexible. And I realized that, you know, hey, maybe this isn't the right way to do it. Maybe I don't know, you know, 100% that this is the most defined way. And the more and more I opened myself up to being more receptive to these things, I feel like I grew a lot better at the tasks that I was doing. And so in my youth, I mean, maybe it was because I was young, maybe because I didn't know any better. I felt that, you know, my way was the only way to do things. And, you know, by hell or high water, people are going to listen to me, and this is how I feel. And, you know, damned if you care, I'm doing it this way. Yeah. And I just, in retrospect, to think like, oh gosh, what a kind of myopic view of, you know, like just ignorance to, you know, to just think that I knew everything better than everybody else and everyone needs to do the things that I say. And so, I mean, it was kind of a hard lesson to learn, you know, because it really required like the introspection to say, you know, maybe I'm not doing this the best that I could, or maybe I could be doing things better. And I think until I really kind of hit that point of understanding, you know, there's probably burned bridges or people that had unpleasant experiences with me where they probably were right and I probably was wrong, or, you know, maybe somewhere in the middle, and kind of, you know, sometimes groupthink and subcultures, and you kind of get into an echo chamber of those things where, you know, you have like-minded people and maybe they agree with you and maybe they don't. And you kind of, you know, smack your head against the wall about it. But I think kind of understanding and empathy of other ideas was what really allowed me to get better at just doing the things that are required of me.
Yeah, man, that was so beautifully said, especially like, a thing that I think a lot of punk people can be good at is stating your case very passionately.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
And out arguing people because, like, I know this in my
soul. Yeah. Right. The very fiber of my being.
Yeah. Says. And when someone speaks to you about something like that, and you're like, wow, this person really believes that, until you realize that they're like that about everything. Like, this is where the coffee maker should be. And I believe that in my soul.
Right. It's kind of pick and choose.
Yeah. And if there's one thing that I know I certainly have struggled with is this side of being like really learning how to pick my spots professionally, when to add things in. And in fact, doing that, honing that has allowed me to be successful in my career now. Like very specifically, today I was sitting in a call that was going sideways, and it was a senior leadership team that I'm not a part of. I'm just coaching in the company. And I had to step in and interrupt the CEO in a very critical time of a conversation because I knew that I had value to add in that moment. And it's a big thing to interrupt anyone at all, but interrupt a CEO when a very specific, challenging decision's being made. And I did it. And afterwards I thought about it and I was like, I got to thank punk and hardcore for giving me the confidence to be in those spaces.
Oh, yeah.
But I got to thank life for teaching me, like, yo, man, shut up until you got something to say.
When's the correct time?
Like, shut up until you got something to say. And it's like, I think back, I love what you said. It's like, there's some people who had like bad experiences with me.
Oh, yeah. So definitely.
Like that really learning. It's not that what you think doesn't matter in general. It's that what you think doesn't matter in every situation at all times to be voiced.
Yeah. Like, why does someone care what I think about some, you know, idea in passing? Why do I need to be the person to say that's a bad idea?
Totally.
Or there's no reason for that.
Or to say it and then to just let that drift into the air and then be like, okay, like I raised my voice enough. You know, like I'm really thankful the world taught me that. And I'm thankful that that Billy Rubin had that quote. That quote has always stuck with me. And I bring it up often because for me, I was like, that's it. But let's flip the switch though, because punk and hardcore does a lot of cool stuff. And it really can help us out. So what's stuff that you learned in punk and hardcore that you know you consistently apply in the world?
So just even on a very, very topical level, when I started at the hospital in 2006, many clinicians and administrators and things like that were not very receptive to the idea of using a computer chart.
Right.
Straight up. You know what I mean? People have been charting in paper. What's wrong with paper?
Right.
Paper allows me to do it. It's quick. I can read it. It's fine for me. It's fine for my patient. Who cares? Right. So a lot of people were not very pleased with efforts to do computer charting and things that we take for granted today. And very many people were very, you know, loose with their criticism of things that were happening in the hospital.
And these are very smart people, like really accomplished smart people.
And I'm being very delicate about this.
Right.
And so there are many people on my team at the time, you know, who were not comfortable with getting screamed at by people, or, you know, getting all this criticism that literally they had nothing to do with. You know what I mean? These are not the correct people be receiving the ire from, you know, these folks. And so they would just tell me, hey, can you go to this meeting for me? I mean, I know it's not what you do, and I know it's not, you're not on this project, but can you just go? And they're probably going to yell at you, but because it's you, they're probably not going to yell at you as much. And I think they're going to make them uncomfortable. So why don't you just go stand in for me? And I just kind of roll my eyes and say, yeah, sure, I'll go. And I'll go and get yelled at. Now I'll go in there and, you know, kind of tower over people and, you know, people, you know, maybe just have that bias of maybe I shouldn't yell at this guy so much, or maybe I wouldn't.
What's the connection of from punk to that?
I think if you go out and you yell at people at a show, most often people will yell at you back. Wow, it's funny how that works, isn't it? You know what I mean? Like, hey, I think your ideas suck. Well, I think you do too. You know what I mean? What do you want to do about it? And so there's kind of like that to it. I mean, it's not like that in the office, but kind of just that, you know, like, oh, I don't have to be afraid of, you know, any of this stuff. You know what I mean? I'm confident enough to know that I think I'm in the right. You know, we'll do this, you know? And so there's a lot of that. And there's a whole lot of do-it-yourself and problem solving that I learned from, you know, punk and hardcore and doing all these things of like, hey, like, how can I make this successful? You know, how can I figure this out? Be it a show or just even, you know, putting something together, hitting deadlines for a record and things of that nature. Really, for me personally, I mean, I know it's different for everyone, but I was a one-man team for a lot of the things that I did back then. And so I was solely responsible for figuring a lot of stuff out. And so there'll be times, you know, in my professional capacity here now as an architect, where there's nobody out there that's going to help me but me. You know, we went live with some of the software in 2009. There's no instructions. The developers sometimes knew, sometimes didn't know. It's not things you can Google. I mean, you can't go to Stack Overflow and be like, hey, how does this, you know, interact with that and whatever? Because that wasn't the thing back then. And so really just digging in and being like, you know what? If I have to sit and listen to an audiobook at 12 hours while I drive to and from work on, you know, this data dictionary, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to figure it out. And so I knew that I had really put that drive and problem solving and all these things, you know, under duress, no less, like at a hardcore show. When the developers for the software that we used started calling me up and saying, hey, we heard you're pretty good at doing this. Can you explain to us how to do this? And, you know, can you explain to us what the best way to get that out is? And so that was when I was like, yeah, you know, I think I've really figured this out. And I think I've really got a handle on what we're doing here. And I mean, as you know, I mean, doing hardcore shows and stuff like that, sometimes it's like, you know, juggling knives while something's on fire and people are screaming at you and, you know, there's a car crash outside. It's very much like that at a hospital.
It's just a sworn enemy weapon.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. I mean, sometimes things are just, you know, chaotic and doing things kind of under duress and pressure. Just, I mean, I just jumped right into the fire and hit the hospital. And I was like, you know what? You know, nothing's going to scare me. I don't think there's anything I cannot do. and I'm going to figure it out, you know?
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. Like the idea, like going back to Discord, Discord Records, and they're like, oh, well, we want to put out a record. Well, why wouldn't we put out a record? Why don't we just figure out how to do it?
Yeah.
And taking apart 7-inch sleeves, oh, this is how they're constructed. Well, we'll just make those. Like, we'll just like literally trace them out and then cut them and then glue them ourselves. We'll do this and that. That like fearless idea. And then not only we'll put out our own records, we'll put out our friends' records. I don't know how we're going to do it. We'll get distribution. I don't know how we're going to tour. I don't know how we're going to do it. That whole like fearlessness of I'm just going to figure it out.
Yeah.
That, I mean, people who don't come on punk and hardcore have this as well, right?
Right.
Like, oh, it's not like unique to this. It's such an interesting like confidence builder that I think really gives people an opportunity to play at a different depth.
Yeah.
With everything.
And it's not hubris. It's more of really just that kind of understanding of like, yeah, I can do this, you know, with enough work. And if I work smart and, you know, I can figure this out, we can do this.
Yeah. Like I can figure this out. That is like, I think one of the most important, if you were to say like, what's anything you take away from Buck and Hardcore is I can figure this out.
Totally. I think anything, you know, you can figure out anything in hardcore, be it, like you said, Discord, putting out records, my friends, hey, I want to put out a record. How do we do that? We'll figure it out, you know, and just kind of putting your mind to it and literally, you know, just creating something out of nothing, you know, because someone had the fortitude to see it through.
Yeah. All right. So when was your first position where you actually had direct reports and you were leading people?
Probably around 2000 and it must have been like 2008, 2009 or something like that. We was a small team back then. We started out with just a handful. There's probably like myself and maybe like 3 or 4 people under me. And so
were you younger than them?
Yes, actually I was. Okay. Yeah. We were all pretty similar, but I think technically I was still probably the youngest.
Okay. So how did you learn how to lead people? And just to be really clear, leadership to me is like an interesting thing because like learning to lead people is not just about like, here are the skills of leadership. It's also about like, how do you think about things?
Yeah.
How do you understand yourself? How do you understand other people?
To be honest, it was very hard. I mean, it was a tough transition because for me personally, working with the folks that we had at the team at the time, you know, we all did a similar style of job, you know, coding and doing analysis and writing specs and things of that nature. And it was real hard for me when people had a problem to just not say, hey, just give it to me and I'll do it and we'll be done. You know, who benefits from that? I mean, I'm one person. There's a finite amount of things I can take off other people's plates.
Right.
There is no benefit to me sitting there over you and doing your code for you while you watch.
Yeah.
You know? And so that was something that I really had a hard time figuring out, or even just in the way that the way I learn is maybe not the way that you learn.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you tell me something once, that's all, and I'll pick it up and I will never forget it. You write it down for me, never forget it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, you know, needed a different type of learning. Like, hey, can you show me an example? Can you explain this to me? Can you do that? And so I used to be, you know, very rigid in my thoughts of like, oh, man, you know, I've explained this to this person and I've shown them that they haven't gotten it yet. Why haven't they gotten it? So just being like, oh, hey, people learn differently. They need me to show them, to figure it out, to explain to them, you know, give them resources and all of these things to pick it up. So then the way I learn is not the way that you learn.
Right.
And so it was kind of tough.
So it was just kind of like trial and error.
We had a lot of that. I went to, I took some classes at UCLA for it to try and get a more serious approach to it in their management programs there and like things of that nature. And a lot of it was just trial by fire in the sense that in between the years of probably like 2009 and maybe 2015, the medical world had huge rapid developments, and especially at Cedars, it expanded. We had all these little small disparate systems that did one singular thing. Like if you were in ED, you may have an application. The ICU had an application. The OR had an application. Ambulatory had an application. And they all started coalescing into this one large ecosystem. And it was just like wildfire. I mean, there were just projects and hundreds of people and all of these things coming together. And me just trying to read and learn as much as I could and be mentored by the people that I know are good leaders. Mm-hmm. And so really just getting, you know, boots on the ground and kind of figuring it out. And I'm sure there were missteps along the way, but I think we accomplished so much that would have been, you know, just heroic in any other place. And for us, it was business as usual, you know, because there was no other option. Failure was not an option.
So what are the lessons that you learned in that first leadership space? Like the things that you learned about yourself and you learned about people?
Yeah, I mean, really just, I would say mostly how to interact with people that were not necessarily on my team, but I needed on my side to get things done. So,
how to win believers and build influence and relationships.
Right. And so for in my particular part in the many, many cogs of the hospital is generally the last one. So the data we disseminate out and we send reports and scripts and files and, you know, integration with other systems is always the last part of the chain. Yeah. So the beginning, you think, okay, well, we're going to pick this project, and then we're going to pick this application, and then we're going to meet with the stakeholder, and all these other things that happen. I assure you, pulling data out is the very last step.
Yeah.
And so people who make build decisions and say, hey, this is what we're going to store, directly affect our team, because if you don't store it, we can't give it to people. Right. You know what I mean? It'd be essentially like you writing me an email and just being like, all right, I don't know, you go figure it out, pull some stuff out of that. Yeah. I need to see all the lab values for this.
Right.
I'm like, well, you just sent me as a text file. Do you know how much work that is to pull it out? Right. Well, we're not going to do anything, you know? And being like, okay, well, now I have to go present my case. I have to say, hey, I know these people, these are stakeholders. This is a very important thing. If we're able to get this build in a timely manner, we can improve results. We can track results. We can provide better patient care. And, you know, really working with these other external stakeholders to get them on my side, to see the things that I'm seeing. Because for them, they might just be like, hey, I don't have the operational resources to do this. Right. Like, it's not in my plan. It's not in my timelines. What value of this is to me? Mm-hmm. And so for us being at the bottom of the chain, you know, with the actual receiving of data and all of these things, is really getting out there and saying like, hey, if we do this, this is going to be such a huge benefit to everybody involved. And I think it's worth, you know, a little bit of pain in the beginning, and we get such a payout at the end. And so that was a constant fight of always having to build these cases and prove, you know, why these things are a good thing for the company.
If you're to think, and I know there's no easy answer to this, but like, what are a few of the challenges for leadership that would be unique to the technology space?
Oh,
so that most leaders wouldn't have to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, so for in our particular example, if you are to migrate something into a production environment in the hospital, without exaggeration, we probably have 80 different environments where that build has to go to.
Right.
So it goes from the production proof of concept environment, and it goes to, you know, the test environment, and it goes to the supplemental test environment, and then it goes to build track, and then it goes in. And it just goes through all these things because so many checks and balances have to happen, right?
Right.
So I joke with my friends who are in tech industries that are not, you know, so highly regulated, where they're like, oh, I don't know, dude. I pushed my code to production immediately with my one test or something like that. Yeah. And I'm just like, holy cow. I mean, for us, you know, for the developers that I had, you know, we would go through high-level functional specs, low-level technical specs, going through, you know, UAT, user acceptance, through all this test, making sure that it's peer reviewed, making sure it's pair coded, all of these, you know, very rigorous things that, you know, we would have to have checklists and timekeeping to make sure that developers were meeting all these checks, you know, where most people can sometimes just be like, I don't know, man, I did it on Agile and I just pushed it out in the morning scrum. Like, that's it. You know, wow, it must be nice, right? It must be great to just have your developer be like, oh yeah, I totally pushed that code to production. We're good. Like, thumbs up.
Something real specific to you. Can I ask you some personal questions?
Yeah, most definitely.
So most people personally and professionally have things they're super secure about.
Yeah.
And they have things they're super insecure about. Mm-hmm. Now, let's keep it in the professional realm. Yeah. What are things that you're super secure about yourself as a professional today? And what are some things that you're insecure about?
For secure, I would say, like, I've been doing this a long time. I mean, I've been working on databases, data warehousing, and data engineering, and all these systems for easily like 25 years. I mean, at this point, with some of the things that I've seen in our accelerator and incubator, all these projects, nothing fazes me anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you could be like, hey, I want a program that does like the craziest thing you can think of. And I'll sit there and go, yeah, I think we can do that. We'll figure it out. And if we can't, we'll find a way where, you know, in the future we can do it, or, you know, can lead to the steps to that being a viable product in the future. Nothing fazes me anymore. I mean, I have seen it all. We've done a ton of things. I am very secure in the fact that I know that you know, my team, we can figure it out. I mean, literally, the things we've seen things everywhere from, you know, using Alexa to get you ice chips in the hospital to, and it sounds crazy, but there's like AI procedures for people's fecal matter and things like that, where it can be analyzed and tell you if you're having like an IBS outbreak and things like that. Wow. So, I mean, it's the full gamut of like things that are far beyond the imagination to things that are very, very simple, you know, and, you know, I'm comfortable that in our environment, there's nothing that phases me anymore. We can do it.
Okay. You know, so what are you insecure about?
What am I insecure about? I mean, sometimes I feel like maybe it's for you the same way with songs, or maybe if you wrote music and things like that. For me, when I write code and I push it out there into the ecosystem, that code, I have code out there from, you know, the early 2000s, and it still runs. And every once in a while, I kind of get that tinge of like, man, I could have done that better. You know what I mean? I know more now, and, you know, maybe the database has changed over time, and I can do that. And I really have a hard time sometimes letting go of some of those things, where when things run, you know, every 10 minutes for 20 years or something like that, I mean, it's got to run well.
Yeah.
And there's no, you know what I mean? If it takes an extra minute, think of all the minutes that have accumulated as a CPU over time, right? And so putting things out there is simultaneously like kind of a big deal and kind of not. I mean, it's not a thing that affects a whole lot of people, but I know I did it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that good enough?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's hard sometimes to not let like perfection be what's stopping you from being complete.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes when I put things out there, any other person would think, yeah, it's fine. What's Matt on about? Like, what is he talking about? It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. Leave it alone. And I kind of have that rock brained idea of like, oh no, I could have done that better. I can do this better. I can do this better. When sometimes the solution is like some super simple thing, you know?
Totally, man.
And I just get so into my own space of overthinking sometimes, you know, and I'll go to a developer and just be like, hey, I'm trying to, why don't you just do that? Oh, yeah. I guess that is a lot simpler than trying to re-engineer the wheel on this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should just use those pre-built libraries and things like that. Like, oh yeah, duh, thanks. So sometimes it's like you just get into your own head so far, and sometimes you just need, you know, that kick to get out of it. And now with COVID and, you know, people working from home, sometimes it's harder to get that connection. So, I mean, I love working from home and it's totally cool, but I do miss just stopping by someone's desk and just being like, hey, let me pick your brain for like 2 seconds. You know, now I really have to go out of my way and, you know, hit them up online and be like, you busy? You might be busy. I don't know by your, you know, your indicator. Can you talk to me for a second?
Yeah.
So really kind of kicking people's door in.
Well, speaking of home, can we talk about your home life for a second?
Yeah, definitely.
So you've had like a professional career from when you were very, very young.
Yeah.
And you've also been with your wife.
Yeah.
Since you were very, very young.
Yeah.
So how long have you been married?
I've been married since 2003. We started dating in 1999. Uh-huh. So it's been quite some time.
And you have two kids?
Yeah, we have two kids. Yeah.
So you're a guy who's like super involved in music still, you know, as much as you can be.
Yeah.
You have a very serious professional career, and you've got what I believe is like, you know, like real rich and healthy family. How do you balance it all?
It's insane. And I would say that unfortunately, my wife has probably bared the brunt of it sometimes when I work, you know, a 60-hour week, or I work, you know, a month in a row with no day off or something like that. She's really the one that holds it down for the kids. My oldest son has high functioning autism, so he requires, you know, a lot of help that, you know, maybe a neurotypical kid wouldn't need sometimes. And my wife pulls a heavy burden of getting a lot of that situated. And so it's very, very, very hard getting all of that to a healthy place sometimes, because there'll be stretches where, you know, my kids wouldn't see me. They wouldn't see me in the morning. I would have left work for like 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. and I would get home as they were going to bed. Right. You know what I mean? And, you know, I'd get 10 minutes to read with them maybe at night, every night, you know, and hang out. And there would just be those spans where I didn't see anyone. And it's real easy to get wrapped up in that. You know what I mean? When you're like, oh, I have these deadlines. And if I don't get these deadlines done, you know, it's going to cause a chain of events that are going to, you know, cause all these problems later on, or things that are unrelated. And so really kind of just taking a time to sort of step back, and I try and cut time out to make sure that, you know, what you might feel as a nuisance, you know what I mean? Or my kids coming by and being like, hey, can you come play with us? And I'm like, they're not doing that to bother. Like, why would I ever think that, you know, they would think that that's bothering? Like, no, I should do that.
Yeah.
And kind of really being like, I need to go spend time and I need to make time for everyone. And then when you do it, you enjoy it. And it's kind of like that, you know, getting out of that funk of sometimes just being deep in these projects and just knowing like, hey, I'm not going to talk to anyone for 2 weeks or something like that, because I'm going to be so wrapped up in this is really kind of lame for everyone involved. And I know it doesn't put me at the top of anyone's list of people they want to hang out with. You know what I mean? Just being cantankerous and, you know, dug in, you know, bunkered in and doing this stuff. So it was really, really, really hard for me. And I know at some point, I'm sure my wife suffered because of decisions that I had made doing all these crazy things. And so now as I've gotten older, I think I've gotten better about my time management and not ending up in projects where I need to work, you know, 60 hours under a deadline, under the gun to get these things done.
Well, and there's also a level of like, and dude, thanks for the being open about that and vulnerable.
It's
like,
hard.
It's hard to talk about.
I mean, yeah. It doesn't make me sound great to say that, you know, unfortunately, relationships are affected and I have my friends that I don't talk to all the time, because it's real hard to say like, hey, look, I'm in the middle of these projects and, you know, whatever. I don't have time to, you know, help you out with something, or I don't have the bandwidth to do, you know, things that I would normally be able to do under any other circumstance. So it's kind of rough.
Totally. And there's also something to be said about like when you're in any pursuit, earning your way up into a position where you have the luxury of giving people the amount of time you want to be able to give.
Right.
And I'm not saying what the right or the wrong here is for anybody. So anyone listening, I'm not telling you need to like sacrifice one part of your life or another. But what I do know is that building up Cadence required a level of energy and commitment, a level of energy I didn't even know I had. And I started Cadence in like a really difficult part of my life, like really difficult time. And it was like a perfect window where I could go all in on something, because if I didn't, I was like, there was enough bad stuff going on in my life that it allowed me to just say, I got to put all my energy into this thing. And I was able to build it up. But I'll tell you, especially those first 2 years, but maybe the first three, I had to work at a pace that was like unparalleled to anything I'd experienced in my life. And I didn't really get to a point where I'd earned my way up to where I could be like, pop my head up and be like, oh, here's life. And then a pandemic comes in, right?
Yeah,
in a pandemic. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'll see you guys in 2 years.
Right.
So again, I'm not telling anyone listening here that you got to sacrifice part of your life to get to your goals. But I will say that like anything worth doing is worth putting everything into. And you got to make sure that thing is actually worth doing. But if it's actually worth doing, you got to look at where you can dig in as hard as you can for a period of time, and know also when you've hit the plateau, when you can stick your head up and be like, hey, I actually want to live my life a little bit differently. I'm finally in a place now where I can spend like really dedicated specific time with my daughter. I have a young daughter who's almost four. I am very fortunate my partner can come with me when I travel for work. She's here right now, and it's cool, but it takes a lot of work to get there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was fortunate enough, and a lot of the time where I spent doing all these crazy hours was before that we had kids.
Yeah.
You know, and then as the kids got older and, you know, they needed more of my time and help with just, you know, things that a dad should do, you know, that's when it really cut to be like, man, I would like to get more time. Like, how can I schedule my professional life where I can get more time to help my kids with the things that they need?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, totally. Okay, so we're heading towards the close of the interview. I got a few questions for you, but is there anything you want to ask me?
No, I mean, I'm just super stoked that, you know, you thought of me to come in here. Because, I mean, I know you know I don't really talk about what I do. So you're taking a chance on me that, you know, I don't do anything that crazy. So I don't know, I think I'm moderately interesting. Right?
What do you think, Spencer?
Yeah. There's only like a handful of people in the world that kind of do what I do. So I think I'm unique in that regard.
What do you think, Spencer?
The Makeout Club.
All Spencer cares about the Makeout Club. He's like, tell me all about it.
Exactly.
Right. I have three questions I want to ask for you. So I know your role now, as mm-hmm. we said earlier on, you don't have any direct reports.
No. Yeah. So I worked on a kind of a parallel level of getting other people's teams to work for me.
Right. So there's got to be a lot of influence involved in that.
Yes. 1000%.
And maintaining relationships
yep.
and creating believers in what you're doing.
Yeah.
So if for anyone who's listening, either young career or someone who's well established, any advice that you have for people about how to lead from influence or how to build yeah. relationships where you get those believers.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think you need to prove, you know, the value that you give, because a lot of people aren't going to have resources to a lot. I mean, maybe someone out there is lucky and has, you know, all the resources, be it money, time, you know, human beings, et cetera. But in my experience, that has never been the case, yeah. you know? And so kind of proving that you're worth and kind of building your case and getting people on board with you, you know, explaining why what you're doing is important. Yeah. You know, it could be anything. It could be, you know, the operation benefits from it. You know, patient for me, is improved. The patient care is improved. Technology is pushed forward. You know, whatever it is finding out what people, moves them and speaks to them, and then getting on board with it and saying like, hey, you know, you'd be a great, you know, your team, your resources, your people, you know, you would be a great boon if you were able to do this for us. And here's why I think you should do it, you know, and kind of leading people to the water and getting them on board. Because, I mean, sure, I guess you can go out and scream and yell at people and try and force their hand. But at the end of the day, it's not going to make anyone like you or want to help you. Yeah. I mean, so I joke when people sometimes that I know are out there and are like, yeah, I yell at these people and I'll show them. And I'm like, sure, that works in, you know, the short term, but you're essentially alienating you from anyone who's ever going to want to do something for you out of, you know, the graciousness of your heart. And so it's two ways. Like, I mean, I help out as many people as I possibly can in the hopes that, you know, when my time comes for them to help me out, you know, it goes both ways.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in, so influence is everything. Power and hierarchy are nothing. Like, influence yeah. everything. And I'd say a very, really important part of influence is know your worth, like know what you're really good at,
yeah,
and feel confident in that. Have a strong track record of delivering results. Like if you're doing something, make sure that you're actually,
oh yeah,
like if I'm confident in something that I do, that confidence should be informed by having a strong track record of right. adding value.
Oh yeah.
But the third thing is do good deeds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it takes nothing sometimes to help people. Like there's, you know, it's so easy to, you know, just give people assistance when they need it.
I once had a kind of friend say to me, man, you're always doing stuff for people. And it's like, kind of like you have this like bank, like, you know, this like, this like bank of things that
yeah,
you've
right,
done for
favors
people, and- yeah, that you expect people to get back at you. And I was like, well, it's an interesting thing that you say. It was like a real, like, kind of like not a nice conversation.
Right.
And I was like, you're not wrong, but you're not right either. And let me put it this way. I just happen to be in a unique position where I can actually help people out
yeah.
a lot. And that's because I'm actually really good at X, Y, and Z. Like I have a skill set in this, a proven track record.
Yeah.
I'm just in a position where I can help people. And I like helping people. I like helping people because maybe it helps my ego, or maybe it makes me feel like I've done my good deed for the day. Or what I think it is, I just genuinely like
yeah.
people being successful.
Exactly.
I love right. seeing people be successful. And he's like, oh, you just do it to get something in the end.
No.
Like, well, hold on. I'll say, it's like, listen, man, like, when you've done a lot of good deeds for people, if 1 out of 10 of those people remembers that when you're in a time of need,
yeah.
that's awesome. But it doesn't mean those other 9 people are like, that's it, you're out of the
club. No, yeah, yeah.
But I don't think it's weird. Like, I think doing good deeds is super important. And I also don't think it's weird to hope and expect that when you're in a time of need, someone
yeah.
could do you a solid, that they do a solid. But also to equally be like, man, you know, and you might not. I think the idea of just like, I'm always going to do a good deed. I think that's kind of bullshit. I don't think a lot of people really like that.
No.
And B, it's like helping people out is, I believe, such an important part of having healthy influence. And having healthy influence, I think, is like one of the most important things that you can have in terms of making good things happen in the world in general.
Yeah. I mean, what's the saying? A rising tide lifts all boats.
100%.
I mean, right. So I'm in the unique position at the hospital where literally I touch every facet and part of the entire, you know, medical system. And so I've met and, you know, made friends with so many people. And, you know, when it comes time for me you know, to ask a favor or even just an opinion or anything, just even, you know, a healthy smile and a hello. Hey, let's go to lunch and hang out. You know, I'm in that unique position where I can meet all these people and do all these things. And like you said, sometimes people are able to help and sometimes they're not. I mean, I don't hold it against them. There's no reason. It's just sometimes they may not be in the position to do it. But when it happens, man, it's great.
It's great. It's totally great. All right, man. Second last question. It's the hardest question I'm going to ask you this whole interview.
Right.
Your choice, either your three favorite West Coast punk or hardcore bands of all time, or current three favorite punk and hardcore bands in general.
I can probably do my current three favorites. I think that's probably easier for me.
Okay. Top three, man. You know this is going to be highly debated.
Yeah, I was going to say, right? Like the things that I've been into a whole lot lately are Mind Force, I think is really cool. They're a really cool band. I don't know them personally. I've got some stuff from them. I assume they're probably younger than I am and seem to be just killing it. You know what I mean? All their albums in that general, that area are just so good. They're so
Mind
good.
Force from the Hudson Valley.
Yeah, Hudson Valley. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Does it have to be punk band?
That could be punk.
Yeah, I mean, like, are you familiar with the band Softkill?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really into them and their thing. You know what I mean? Like, I have a huge collection of records from them, like test presses and stuff like that. They're kind
are they punk, goth?
Or yeah, exactly, wave? Right?
Like, yes, but okay.
Yeah. Softkill. Yeah. I'm really into them as well. And then a shout out to the homies in Berthold City. You know what I mean? Like, come on, dude. Like, that's so good. I'm so excited for that. As the time that we're talking, the LP is not out yet. It should be out soon. But there's a band that just really, I mean, I think is people I'm friends with and good music and good times. And it's just really cool.
All incredible picks. I firmly believe Mind Force is the best hardcore band going right now. I think they're my favorite.
Yeah, they're killing it, dude. Yeah. It's so crazy. Just like that level of intensity and just like, man, those albums are so good. There's no filler at all. It's just 100%, you know, shred.
The songwriting is phenomenal.
Yeah.
The dude whoever is the premier song, like the main songwriter, should become a producer.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just so good. Also, there's another band. I don't know if you've heard of them. It's a fourth one. It's called Change. Are you familiar with them?
How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you? All right. Final question. Easiest one. Anything you want to shout out or anything where you'd like people to look up you or your efforts?
Yeah, for sure. You can always check out. I don't really use a whole lot of social media because I'm kind of a hermit in that regard, but I do use Instagram. I'm on there as Iron Yuppie, a good Simpsons reference for those who get it out there. It's mostly just me posting about like random 90s Northern California hardcore stuff. My wife, Nikki, is doing a zine in this summer, maybe this fall, called Today Forever. And I'm helping her out with the art, stuff like that. And so it should be pretty cool. Keep an eye out for that. Shout out to my friend Steve at Heroes and Martyrs. I did a ton of stuff helping out with the recent No Warning 7-inch. Uh-huh. We went deep into the archive to find things that were, you know, I'm a pack rat. For those who don't know, I literally just store all kinds of old stuff. So I have all the old masters and files and all those things for the original Martyr records. And then if you're interested in the accelerator at Cedars-Sinai, check it out. You can find it on there and a little bit more about what we do and the companies we work for and the technologies that we're pushing for. It's all really, really interesting stuff if you're interested in like tech or medical or anything of that nature.
Heck yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much. Anything you want to add as we close off?
No, we're good, man. Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome. All right, everyone, I'll see you in the outro. And Spencer, drop the beat. Hey, thanks, Matt, for being on the show. That was super cool. It's neat when you, like, you've known people for a long time and you've got this shared passion. So for us, it's like punk or hardcore, but it could be like cycling, it could be hiking, camping, whatever it is. And then one day you're like, I actually don't know what you do. And then what they do is like ultra interesting. When I learned what Matt did, of course, I became interested in having him on the podcast because A, he's just a great guy, someone who I think is like a great steward of our subculture and like cares about it. Someone who's like, I think is like legitimately a fan of punk and hardcore. And that's it. It's fine to pick a lane, you know, but like, I love it when people just love like a lot of different kinds of music. I think it's a cool way to approach it. But also it's just like a good guy. And the further we got into talking about what he did, the more I was like, damn, like, this is why I think it's so important to the things that you learn in punk and hardcore, and or even the things that you learn in the idea of like, or in subculture of just like building something, being a part of something, being on the forefront of something. Because a lot of subculture is kind of like the bellwether for what's going to come. Like people who've been involved in subculture and who've actually played a part in it, very often I think have something really important to add to like the bigger things we create in life. You know, if you think about Matt's story, he's like on the forefront of all this crazy technology. He's working in this field where it's like, if you were just to sit down and talk with him about like hardcore from Sacramento, you would never guess what he does. But he's been a part of all these things. Punk isn't the only element in that. Subculture isn't the only element in that, but it is like a big part of that story. And, you know, I'd say anyone who's in subculture, who's like younger or kind of thinking about the career change, it's like, don't be shy to actually use that as a part of a selling point of the value that you can add. And for anyone who might be like a hiring manager and thinking about bringing people in, people who are part of subculture, and I don't just mean punk and hardcore, I just mean anything. I also mean people who might be from like marginalized identities who've had to figure out like, how do I get my voice heard? Or how do I like make myself more visible? How do I change these stigmas that might be there? People who are like in the forefront of doing stuff that are in like smaller communities, they have a lot of skills. And these skills are like super important about pushing the ball forward, making change and making the world a better place. So with that, again, Matt, thank you so much for the time. If you haven't yet, then please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. My name is Aram Arslanian, and this is One Step Beyond. One step! One step beyond.